This is a fascinating topic, World War II, and what really happened back then. We are learning more and more all the time. Revisionists, historians, scholars, eyewitnesses come forward. Government documents of various sorts and many different kinds are slowly but surely being released. Have they been tampered with? Are they legitimate? In most cases, we're finding out all kinds of things, and it's like a delayed treasure hunt in a way. And it's always that way, though. It takes 50, even. We still don't know the full truth about the Civil War in America, for goodness sakes. We're still finding out things about that. Dr. Henry Macko, Ph.D., writes for Rents.com, and turns out a stream of provocative essays and articles, not the least of which is the one I have up in Featured Stories this week, entitled The Ugly Cause of World War II, The Murder of Lord Errol. This is a very interesting footnote. It may be larger than a footnote. It's maybe a pivotal issue. Let's find out more with Dr. Henry Macko. Welcome back, Henry.
Hi, Jeff.
How are you?
Pretty good.
Okay, we got Hi, Jeff, and Pretty Good. Nice book, 200 words, and you said four.
Well, you just asked me how I was.
All right. In general terms, I really want to thank you for all the wonderful things you've contributed, not only to my site, but to all those who seek the truth and to seek other information upon which to base their own analyses and things. You've just done a remarkable job for quite a long period of time, and I do express the gratitude not only from me, but from many, many of your fans.
Well, thanks, Jeff, and if it weren't for your website, hundreds of thousands of people wouldn't be able to read these articles, but I don't know where we'd be without your website, so the gratitude is reciprocated.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that very much. It's, as you know, a lot of work. The Murder of Lord Errol. Let me just read the first two short graphs from Henry Macko's article, and if you want to read it, and I urge you to do so, just go to rents.com. RENSE.com and scroll down the featured stories at the top and you'll find it there. Jocelyn Victor Hay, 22nd Earl of Errol, a prominent British colonial politician, knew the real cause of the Second World War and had the stature to be heard. Winston Churchill ordered the Secret Service, the Special Operations Executive, to kill him. What ugly secret would make the British government kill a British citizen and pass it off as an unsolved murder? Interesting opening to a fascinating essay. Tell us more about this fellow. And of course, we know now, if I might just parenthetically drop in here, that murder is a common tool of world geopolitics, and it's used all the time. So not a big surprise.
Yeah, I would estimate that there must be going thousands of prominent politicians who were murdered. We could talk about who some of them were later.
I agree. That's a very important statement. I agree.
Yeah, their modus operandi seems to be that, happily they don't murder people like me or you, Jeff, because we're, quite removed from the actual events. But if someone has firsthand knowledge of certain events, his life is definitely in jeopardy. It's the, firsthand knowledge seems to be the criterion.
And the best way it is said, and it's common knowledge, for people like that to protect themselves is usually to put it out, whatever they have, in a big and obvious, ostentatious fashion as quickly as they can, and then they no longer are the keeper of something that could get them in trouble. At least that's the prevailing wisdom on how to stay safe when you have dangerous information.
Yeah, well, and that makes sense, because then it hardly makes any point of killing them.
Right.
Anyway, I became interested in... I became aware of Lord Errol because... one of my favorite movies back in the 80s was White Mischief, which was a popular portrayal of his death. But and I recommend the movie to your listeners. It's an excellent movie, except it follows the storyline intended by British intelligence that he was probably murdered by the husband of the older husband who he embarrassed and humiliated by taking up with his young bride. And the old guy got his revenge. And the movie does a lot to show how humiliating the old guy was and how insensitive Laurel was, Errol was. So that's the way the movie goes. And in the movie, and in real life, the old cuckold, Sir Henry Broughton, is not convicted. He's acquitted. So, and that's the way the movie goes. And it's a great movie, but it's really about the decadence of life in Kenya, supposedly, and about what a cad Lord Errol was. And it's a good thing that this book by Errol Trebinsky was written, because it sets the record straight. I just came across this book at a book fair last week, and I just picked it up, and I. You know, I'm always sifting around trying to find evidence of the hand of the Illuminati in world events, and this book did not disappoint, because it goes into a lot of detail. The author had contacts in security, British security, who were retired, and they're dying, and they just didn't want to meet their maker. With this knowledge that Lord Errol was actually a dynamic and an honest, very promising politician who was killed by Churchill, by the British, well, the central bankers, because of some information he knew. And so in reading the book, I tried to come up with what information could be so horrible that they would kill a prominent British colonial politician. He was a member of the armed forces. He was about to be promoted to colonel. There's no question that he was involved in any kind of treasonous activity.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, let me tell your listeners how he was killed. Essentially, two agents flagged him down, a woman and a man, pretended their car was broken, and the woman asked for a ride back to town. This all took place in Nairobi in 1941, January 41, and then she basically just shot a flashlight in his face and blinded him, and then shot him behind the ear. And she and the other agent were basically flown out of Nairobi the next day to Cairo. Initially, the murder was reported as a driving accident. Oh, he killed himself from reckless driving. But then Henry Broughton was arrested and accused of the murder. And then there was a lengthy trial, but Broughton got off because his guns did not match the guns that were used in the gun that was used in the murder. So
it was Broughton was back home.
Pardon me?
Broughton was back home. Was
back
he not?
Home. Pardon me?
In the UK.
No, he was in Kenya when this happened.
Oh, I missed that part.
Oh yeah.
Okay, so
yeah, he was he was living with his wife who was probably 25 years his junior, and
is colonial Africa too, so
yeah, right. But the key is, it turns out that Broughton and his wife, that was a marriage of convenience, and they were both MI5 assets, and their job was essentially to provide this to ingratiate themselves with Lord Errol. It just shows how thorough British intelligence is. They covered all the bases.
Oh, this is 1941, wartime, so.
Yeah. So they basically sent in Broughton and this young woman, Diana Caldwell, and she started an affair with Errol. Errol was this know, handsome 6'2" hunk, and he seemed to have, you know, be irresistible to women, and women seemed to be irresistible to him. So after the break, I'll tell you what his secret was.
Yes. Well, the irresistible woman syndrome. And we'll find out the secret of that and other things as we continue right after this short break. Remember, you can read this story at Rents.com. It's called The Ugly Cause of World War II, and it's a pretty heavyweight piece. Back in a minute. Concealing some pretty ugly details of World War II. Errol was 6'2", as you said, a natural leader, heir to an ancient Scottish lineage, organized, intelligent, as you write, an excellent speaker with a photographic memory, member of the Kenyan colonial legislature, held the post of military secretary with important military and intel duties. Go ahead.
Okay, well, we have to sort of scroll back to the 30s, or actually to before Hitler came to power in 1933. Hitler was essentially financed by Wall Street, by rich German industrialists, and by the Bank of England. And, you know, Hitler, in Hitler's mind, he'd have to say, well, why are these people financing the Nazi Party? And of course the answer is that Hitler represented a challenge to communism, and to the threat of communism, and to the threat of communist Russia.
And communism, which had gotten completely out of control by then, and worried Western Europe.
Exactly. In fact, it was very strong in Germany, and there was and in many other Western European countries, and it represented a genuine threat. After the First World War, the communists were able to take over cities like Munich and Hamburg for a few days. It was a genuine a communist takeover was a genuine threat, and communism then and always has always been a an arm of the Soviet Union. It's never been anything but. Hitler saw himself as a someone who was going to conquer Russia. That was his main ambition. He didn't really care. He had no interest in conquering England, and that's basically Western propaganda to make him, you know, look like he wanted conquer the whole world. Russia was his target.
That merits repeating, Henry. Hitler had great respect for the English, and obviously that respect was probably rooted in a lot more than just history. He was directly involved at some point with British money, with American money. He knew that the English were not the target. And look at Dunkirk. His generals were absolutely flabbergasted when he ordered them to hold back. He could have captured virtually the entire British army at that point, but he didn't want to. He allowed them to escape. There was a reason for that. He only bombed England in retaliation for Churchill's ordering the bombing of Berlin. People don't know that either. But he did understand that the big threat, and he saw it in his own German people and his own country, was communism, and that was the driving force behind the whole thing.
Exactly. Now, I have, you know, I think you'll agree that the alternative he presented, especially to Russia, was as bad or worse than communism. I mean, he planned to totally subjugate Russia. He had no interest in liberating the people from communism. If he did, it would cast a totally different complexion on things.
By the way, had he been more, not obsessed, but certainly driven to that ideal, he would have won the war against Russia. That's one of the key things he did not do, was win the Russian people over and support them.
Deliberately, for some reason. He wasn't deceitful in a way. He made clear that he had every intention to subjugate them, to turn them into slaves. So they fought like the devil to stop them, and they succeeded. You'd think he would have been a little more devious, but he wasn't.
There was a remarkable documentary I saw. I don't know if you saw it or not, Henry, called How Hitler Lost the War. And there were three reasons. One was, as we were talking about, he failed to rally the Russian people behind him. Two, he completely bungled the technology that was dropped in his lap, especially with the Messerschmitt 262, which he could have had operational in 1942 as an air superiority fighter and decimated the bombing raids, which were slowly reducing Germany to a pile of ruin. He blew that. And I forget what the third one was, but there were three major errors he made. And
that's fascinating. In any case, so that's the way Hitler viewed the war, and the reason he did is because partly is he was on intimate terms, and by intimate I mean intimate terms with a little clique of a little occult homosexual clique. Hitler was probably a homosexual that spanned the Nazi and British elites, and they were called the Thule Society and also the Order of the Golden Dawn. These were British aristocrats and Nazis and German aristocrats who were homosexuals, and they literally slept together.
Keep in mind also that homosexuality has been a part and parcel of the upper classes in England for centuries. It has, you know, it's an accepted part of the landscape, maybe even more so than any other European country. So, yes, very important points. All right, we progress in this fascinating story, and we'll continue in just a couple of minutes. Okay, and we're right back. Dr. Henry Macko, Ph.D. Essentially, again, to recap for you, Hitler was not interested in a world war. Most specifically, he sure as hell didn't want a two-front war. His design, his aim, his intent, and why he was funded was to conquer the USSR in a loose Nordic alliance with England. All right. Churchill's backers, the privately owned Bank of England, funded Hitler as a means to intimidate Stalin, destroy Germany, and have a world war. Of course, everybody profits. The big business people profit in war. It also concentrates power and wealth in the hands of these global bankers and industrial corporate magnates and enables them to slaughter national elites who might interfere with their plan for world dictatorship. That's a quote from Henry's article. And I might add something here. Did you ever see the quote from Churchill written long after the war in which he said, World War II, I'm going to paraphrase it here. Maybe I'll come up with a real quote here during the program. He said, World War II had nothing to do with fighting National Socialism, the Nazis. He said, it didn't matter to me or us if Hitler was in charge of the Nazis or the Pope of Rome. World War II was fought for one primary reason, to destroy Germany and the German people forever. And that's from Churchill.
Exactly. And I use that quote in my article, Winston Churchill Illuminati, which you have on your site as well.
Oh, that's where I saw it, too. Okay.
Yeah. So what to pick up the story, we essentially have Hitler thinking of himself as almost an agent of, anti-communism. And thinking this is why he's being backed by Wall Street and the Bank of England.
Well, I would probably think the same thing.
Yeah, and then he was on intimate terms because his circle of German Nazi homosexuals were essentially sleeping and fraternizing with British aristocratic homosexuals, and. One of them was Douglas Hamilton, the 14th Duke of Hamilton, and he was the one that Hess went to see in May of 1941.
Mm-hmm.
But that's already 3 months after they killed Errol. Errol was a close friend of Hamilton, and although I don't think Errol was a homosexual, he may have been bisexual at some point, I'm not sure. In any case, he was part of this clique that was, encouraging Hitler to see himself as the conqueror of Russia, with the support of the West, and essentially, Errol didn't know, and what many members of this clique didn't know, was that there was a greater game, and that is essentially to get Hitler to attack Russia and then essentially involve him in a two-front war. And the greater game is the one you mentioned when you refer to my article. The greater game was to smash Germany once and for all. That was the greater game. But many of these British homosexual elitists didn't know about that. What they did know was that in May of 1940, first of all, in September of 39, Hitler made this incredible deal with the Russians, which left him free to take care of the West, the famous Russian Ribbentrop-Molotov Pact, 1 week before World War II started. And as everyone knows, they divided up Poland. So, and then in May of 1940, Hitler essentially conquered Western Europe, and the British were prostrate. They were basically they'd been badly defeated, and there was a great deal of sentiment in England to make peace with Hitler, especially since Hitler wanted to make peace and offered all kinds of advantageous terms. England would keep its empire and so
absolutely
on.
Yeah,
yeah. And so there's a lot of pressure given the military situation to make peace with Hitler, since Hitler seemed to have a grievance with England. Churchill essentially represented the central bankers and that element of the aristocracy that the Illuminati, I think, which is conscious of the larger plan. And so they essentially put off making peace while at the same time led Hitler to believe that, yeah, this was still a possibility, until they could ensure that that Roosevelt would be elected for a third term. I'm not really quite sure how he was able to run for a third term. But in any case, as we all know, he's the only president ever ran for four terms.
Mm-hmm.
And what they did, and I covered this in another article, bankers, engineer, U.S. World War II intervention. They somehow arranged for the Republican Party to be taken over by a Democrat, an ally of Roosevelt, Wendell Willkie.
Mm-hmm.
And that's in another article. So that happened in May, June of 40.
80 or 90% of Americans wanted nothing to do with this war.
Exactly.
That is incredible.
Yeah, exactly. Yet somehow they managed to take over the Republican Party,
right,
which I describe. It's described in a book that I refer to in that article. Wendell Willkie would be, you know, just Google Wendell Willkie and you'll find the article. And so once Churchill knew he had the United States roped in, because Roosevelt worked for the same central bankers, it was just a matter of, you know, putting Hitler off, putting him off, so that, and Hitler's basically agenda was to attack Russia in the first place. So although we bombed England, it was mainly just to get England to, you know, make peace. And the English just held off, knowing, because they could read the German signals from Ultra, that Hitler was planning to attack Russia anyway. So they just had to put him off so he would fall into the trap of attacking Russia, and then they would come in on the west, and he'd be, and Germany would be ground down between these two great powers.
Exactly. The former very high official in the Finnish government made this very statement not too many months ago. I read it, and I put it up as well. And he was the first one that I remember in a governmental position making the statement that Germany was set up, Hitler was set up, and crushed. And it sounds weird, but that's exactly what happened. Okay, we'll be back in just a few. Right back with you, and Dr. Henry Macko, Ph.D. All right, so how did Lord Errol take a bullet behind the ear for all of this?
Well, you know, there's still information to be dug out, but he seemed to have been a good friend of the Duke of Hamilton. Hamilton seemed to have been very much part of this homosexual clique that was involved with the Nazis. 3 months after Errol's death, Rudolf Hess flew to Scotland specifically to see the Duke of Hamilton,
mm-hmm,
with a generous peace proposal. Now, both men were homosexuals. Possible that they were both lovers. I read that Hamilton had an affair with Albrecht Haushofer, son of Hess's mentor. These guys were thick, and it was the Duke of Hamilton who, I'm sure he had orders from on high, but he basically convened the meeting that took place in the summer of 1940 that was held to decide what to do with Lord Errol. And my conclusion is that Errol was anti-communist, saw no reason why England needed to go to war with Germany,
mm-hmm,
and knew how thick Churchill and Hamilton and the King Edward the Eighth were with the Nazis, and of course didn't know that they were setting up the Nazis. They were, you know, Errol was not aware of the larger agenda, and they felt he just knew too much about the trap they had set for Hitler, because. As you know, they had to make it appear to the world like Hitler is the great aggressor and he wanted to take over the whole world, right? And so, you know, they felt that they couldn't leave Errol free to possibly speak out at a later date. And what, in fact, they did is they sent in this woman, Diana Caldwell, that had an affair with him, and he must have told her things that... that led them to believe that, you know, that they were correct in having him killed.
Hmm. Wow.
You know, but, you know, they put a lot of people in prison. They could have put him in prison. I guess they just couldn't think of an excuse. You know, I mean, we're not aware of it, but all the people that were involved with the Nazis, thinking that they were, you know, like the Nazis thought that they were doing what the government wanted, you know,
right.
This was British policy, they all ended up in prison. You know, right, during 1940, 39-40, hundreds of people, Admiral Domvo, Captain Ramsey, who was an MP, they wrote books about it, The Nameless Wars, Ramsey's book,
mm-hmm.
From Admiral to Cabin Boy is Domvo's book. It's quite an interesting period of history that I have just, you know, touched the surface of it.
Well, it's fascinating. It's also worth mentioning, and I think it's mandatory we mention it, that homosexuality was not the reserve of these particular groups we've been talking about. It cut across all lines in the upper levels of British government and still does to this day, and it's certainly not absent in this country. Homosexuality, pedophilia, you name it.
Yeah, homosexuality seems to be part of this occult group that is empowered by the central bankers, and essentially Satanists, and homosexuality seems to be a big part of it.
I think a lot of it's used for blackmail, frankly, but you get somebody over the line once and they're there. They're stuck.
Yeah, it could be used for blackmail, or it could be that they're gradually indoctrinating us into their cult.
Right, sure. Agreed. So, all right, well, we know what happened at the end of the war. And what's interesting is if you read any of the statements by Hitler toward the end of the war, he did, in fact, accurately forecast basically what would happen over the next 50 years. I mean, he could see it all coming. And why shouldn't he? He's right in the middle of it.
You know, but he does, because he is Hitler, characterize it as, you know, you are all going to fall into the midst of the Jew, you
Correct.
Know?
Oh, yeah. Well, that's Hitler, as you pointed out.
Yeah, that's Hitler, exactly. But the fact is, the central bankers, I mean, everyone wants to be the friend of the person who's got the money machine, right?
Always.
And essentially, they have bought everybody, and people don't even know they've been bought. They bought everybody and everything, and Western society is bought and paid for and controlled subtly by the, you know, this clique, and it's by now it's a lot bigger than 100 Jewish families. That's for sure.
Yep. It's a huge combine. Well, huge. It's small, but it's huge, and it cuts across all lines. They're just united in a common front of abject control and rape and pillage of the planet.
Exactly. Like and so while we're talking about the subject of anti-Semitism, you know, I always felt that. You know, that to a certain degree, anti-Semites, you know, were responding to, you know, a genuine conflict of interest, you know, and had a case. And therefore, I was open to listen to what they have to say, and I still am. But I discovered recently that what the real definition of an anti-Semite is, and it's not someone who's got a conflict of interest. It's someone who believes that every single Jew is aware of this world government conspiracy and is involved in it. And no non-Jews are involved in it.
Right.
And I've had this conversation with countless so-called anti-Semites, and they say, oh, you know, that's Jew think what you're doing, Henry, and this is, you know, and what we're doing is goy think. Yeah, it is goy think. They can't seem to realize that the vast majority of Jews, like everybody else, don't even believe there is this conspiracy, let alone think they're part of it.
Well, thanks for saying. I've been saying that for a long time too, and it's absolutely correct. Anti-Semitism ought to be renamed anti-Jew or anti-Jewish. The word Semitic is a little nebulous. It's misleading, and it just doesn't really seem to fit the expression. But there are a lot of anti-Jewish people out there now who do view all Jews as the enemy, and nothing could be more heinously incorrect. It's wrong, and that's the long and short of it. Then we have Zionism, which, of course, has a couple of factions, and Zionists, being the geopolitical parasitic ghouls that they are, have been smart enough to use the Jewish faith as a shield for God knows how long now. Anyone who criticizes Zionism, most Zionists, of course, are the most powerful Zionists are Jewish. There are more Christian Zionists than there are Jewish Zionists, but they sold their own people out in World War II. Those are the Jewish faith. We know about the 100,000 Jewish children who were inoculated and killed in that hideous experiment by other Jews, probably Zionists. It goes on, and it's a very cloudy picture, and I and you and others have been certainly trying to bring some clarity to it. It's not easy to do, but...
The Zionists and communists are both in power, are both instruments of the central bankers.
Thank you.
Jeff, we know that everyone is busy making a living, you know. Nothing gets done unless someone is paid to do it, you know.
Right.
And the only people who've got that kind of money, you know, and control of the media, which is essential in creating the illusion that these movements...
Well, they don't control it, they own it.
Exactly, they own it. So that creates the illusion that these movements are actually spontaneous and creates a sense of grievance and so on. So both these movements are... And practically everything that happens, as far as I can see, there's this hidden hand of the central bankers funding it. You know, they fund the environmentalist movement. I don't think there's anything they don't fund. You know, and essentially we've got our whole intellectual elite.
They don't fund
academia, right. Media. They're all whores.
They are. They don't fund Rents Radio or Henry Mackow, but they fund damn near everybody else. It seems like.
That's right.
It's a very important point. Everybody's got a price. Remember the Magic Christian, that movie? You've got a price. They just keep writing larger checks until they buy whoever they want. It's simple. And they have the game locked up, and they have supercomputers and models continually being created, and they run simulations, and they know how far they can go. The control through the Tavistock Institute is devastatingly...
I think a large number of the intellectuals, they know they're bought and paid for. They act like they already live in a communist society where they're hush hush and oh no, don't quote me and oh no, I can't say that and they've got this kind of apologetic air about them. You know, these are professors who know what they're not supposed to say, what they're not supposed to investigate, what they know will never get published. You
right.
know, it's like we're already living. I mean, in a police state. And then the other segment are oblivious to this, and they're just being encouraged just because they're stupid. Because if you read the Protocols of Zion, it says we're going to fund mediocrity. We're going to make sure that the idiots rise to the top to make sure that the people with brains sure don't, you know?
There you go. And whether the protocols are a forgery, a hoax, or a fraud, it doesn't matter because there's a hell of a lot of truth in there.
Yeah.
In terms of the mechanism the strategy, the tactics, and the success of SAME waged against all of us by that that moneyed elite. It's really all spelled out in there.
It is. It's for a forgery, it's brilliant.
Whatever. Okay, back in a couple of minutes with Dr. Henry Mackall, Ph.D. We'll continue with another hour. Much more to talk about. Fascinating look at World War II and the control, which continues even more viciously and virulently today than ever. Okay, right back with you, Jeff Rentz, with Dr. Henry Mackall, Ph.D., writes for Rentz.com. Find his articles up there. Look under columnists, and you'll find a whole bunch of Henry's articles as well. His current one is excellent. It's up in Featured Stories. We talked about that last hour. Anything you want to add to this issue of anti-Semitism, Semitism, Zionism, and all the rest of it, which, you know, I'll tell you one thing about this whole issue, and I'm glad to see it. I don't know how widespread it is, but there are certainly a lot more people now, including many of our Jewish listeners and supporters, who are beginning to understand the deception which has been wrought upon them. They are victims, number one, at the hands of Zionists and the global elite. They've been used for such a long time. There is, of course, an heir that is readily discernible out there, as espoused by many, that is anti-Jewish because of the manipulation in the media and so forth, and that is to the benefit of Zionism. They use anti-Semitism and always have. So
exactly, the anti-Semites play right into the hands of the bankers.
Oh yeah, they love
it. By basically saying every Jew is condemned by virtue of his genetics, you know, to be this, you know, evil force and to be dishonest, and you know that's just not true, you know.
Well, we are making some headway in clearing the air a little bit, but without access to the mainstream media, it's an impossible task. But we do what we can do.
Hey, yeah, exactly. Yeah, just a few just final notes about this Errol story.
Yeah.
First of all, I want to recommend, you know, my main source is this book called The Life and Death of Lord Errol by, coincidentally, a woman by the name of Errol Trebinski, who lives in Kenya.
Mm-hmm.
It's a marvelous book, and this woman deserves a lot of credit for basically setting the story straight before posterity. I mean, Errol's been dead now for 65 years, but, and you know, his legacy would have been totally wrong had it not been for the courage and the dedication of this woman to write the story, write this book. Just another little note. It's amazing to me, but Errol was so we don't get the idea that he was some kind of pro-Nazi. He was part of a movement in Kenya to make sure that Tanganyika didn't get given, Tanzania, I guess, which was called Tanganyika, didn't get given back to the Germans as part of the deal, as part of a peace deal, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Even though he wanted peace with Germany, he wasn't. He represented the interests of the Kenyans, who did not want of the Kenyan British settlers who did not want a German colony next door. And so, I mean, he was he represented the interests of his own people. He should not be confused as someone who was pro-Nazi necessarily.
Right. All right, good point. I go back to that quote by Churchill, just an out-and-out hatred for Germany and the German people, which stemmed from World War One, I guess, and so on. But it was the driving force that that pushed the inducement of the United States to come into the war, the whole thing. There was there, and to this day, Germany remains a nation and a people who have been hobbled and are on their knees.
Castrated.
Yeah, well, there you go.
Yeah, that's the word that comes to mind. And if anything, the history of the Second World War is, full of national tragedies. And it's just wrong that it should be identified with just the Jewish tragedy, which was great. But sometimes I think the Jewish tragedy is being used to overshadow or to obscure the tragedy that befell the German people who, were basically did not want to go to war. It was basically Hitler that dragged them into war.
Right.
And they essentially got, suffered a great deal.
Well, after the war, how many Germans were liquidated? 8-9 million? Nobody even knows.
There were Germans in prison of war camps into the early 1950s.
Yeah.
And
I was hideous. And Eisenhower and de Gaulle and Churchill, of course, presided over the liquidation, the genocide of over a million German soldiers after the war ended. And no one knows about this.
But at the same token, the Nazis did the same things to the Russians. So, but the average soldier didn't make these decisions.
No.
And they were the ones that suffered.
You know, I got to say one other thing, the facts are, there remains to this day an astonishing amount of respect, if not awe, for the German military and what it almost pulled off. It fought as almost superhuman in many of the battles. They were extraordinary. Here's this German ingenuity, this competence, this discipline, which had been, I guess, the envy of many countries, and certainly the British hated them for 200 years and or more. And they're just the technology. Had they been able to perfect the atomic bomb, they would have likely won the war. I mean, I don't think there's any doubt about it, but
they came
very close.
And the consequences would have been a lot worse than what we've got now, I'm sure. But the fact is that it's a shame that the generals were such order takers. They could have...
Oh, they just... Absolutely.
They could have gotten rid of Hitler in a flash.
Well, a lot of people are drawing parallels to today.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody knows that Iraq is a rape, an abomination, that depleted uranium is not the uranium weapons, these are nuclear weapons, is literally sowing death and destruction around the world, and these people keep saying, yes, sir, whatever you want, sir, and the genocide and the irradiation of these countries, Afghanistan, Iraq, Yugoslavia, it's beyond belief, and no one challenges.
No. What is treason when the country has been taken over by traitors?
It's mind-boggling to see the whole thing being played out every day. And remember, they own the media. Jeff doesn't. We don't get on Alex Jones. That we don't. Henry Mako. We do the best we can. But we are in the distinct. We're like little kids on the side of a big lake throwing pebbles in the water. That's the best analogy I can come up with. But on the other hand, the average American intuitively knows things are wrong, and those Americans who do visit the internet and are able to wade through the noise and disinformation, lies and deceit to look for the truth and who have the fortitude to do that are finding out what pretty well approximates the truth, and it is almost beyond measure an horrific proposition. Is that too strong?
No, no. And I have to especially give credit to the fellow that made that 9/11 loose change.
Oh, yeah, Dylan Avery. I've had him on twice.
Yeah.
What a great kid. Jeez.
Yeah, man. What a great movie. And also the other movies about 9/11. These movies are now, as you know, available on Google. I mean, they're irrefutable. My wife's cousin sent a link to that movie to my wife's mother, and these people are totally apolitical.
Right.
It's getting out there. The word is getting around.
And they're worried about the Internet. That's the only thing that is really standing in their way of abject control, the Internet.
Yeah.
And they're working around the clock to try to come up with some. They flooded it with the most despicable kind of disinformation scum. Many of you know about this. It's very difficult in other cases to discern reality from fiction. You get 95% reality and a 5% spin. And every obstacle possible is being thrown up between you good people and your chance at the truth on the Internet. And I salute all of you for being wise enough to wade through these things and entertain as many views as you can and as much data as you can while you're making your own decisions. And that's what we try to do here. And you guys are it, you know. This is the smartest audience, I will say it again, that I feel that has ever been assembled in one program in talk radio. You guys are terrific. And you gals, too. Of course, now everybody's a guy, right? Okay, back in just a couple minutes. Did you know that our nation's emergency... also writes about many other things, and one of the most inflammatory subjects, of course, of our times is the issue of feminism and the role it played in the destruction of the so-called American nuclear family. The American psyche has been battered by it. It has confused at least two and a half generations of young women and adult women. Who are they? What is their role? The confusion continues. Men become trivialized more and more in the media. It is anybody who goes to see films or anything else will see men portrayed as weak, indecisive, subservient, idiots, imbeciles, and all the rest of it in many cases. This, of course, is the antithesis of the old-style male role, which was played in the movies, which was the opposite of that. But there somewhere has to be a happy medium. We've seen the pendulum pretty well swing both ways, haven't we?
Yes, for sure. But in order to undermine resistance to their, you know, their rule, they have to pretty well emasculate men. Psychologically, women empower men by essentially obeying them. And when you have women challenging men, you essentially have women doing the job of the elitist, of emasculating men, because men weren't designed to fight women. and to compete with women. They were designed actually to protect and provide for their wives and for women. So,
What do our young people do, Henry? Now, the women are the predators. It used to be the other way around, or at least that's the way it seemed. The women, of course, always had the majority of power because they just had it. They didn't know it necessarily, but I think most of them did intuitively. And men now, what are they supposed to do in society here?
Well, first of all, I think we have to be clear about this power thing. Men still have the power, and I don't mean economic power. I mean, this is all about reproduction. And essentially, a woman's power lasts roughly from roughly corresponds to her fertility. We're talking 17 through 27, 32 maximum, 35 in extreme maybe. That's the source of woman's power, her fertility. While male power, we're fertile. I don't have to tell you, we're fertile into old age.
Well, most of us used to be until the environmental catastrophe that we're living in now, and that's
right.
But
and not only that, as men get older, they get more self-assured, more self-confident, more successful. They have more means. So, in a sense, male power increases. So it's very important that men realize that they have the power, and women are being tricked into squandering and misusing their power in such a way that they're essentially left high and dry, because instead of establishing a lifetime relationship with a man and a family that they will nurture and will nurture them, they're pursuing careers which make them essentially unattractive as wives and mothers most of the time.
So in other words, what you're saying is women often find themselves at 27, 30, 35 with no successful family.
Feminism is a cruel, the very cruelest hoax you can play on a woman. And far from being pro-woman, it is so anti-woman, you cannot believe it. And what's the surprise? Communism, which was, you know, feminism is brought to you by the same people who brought us communism. Communism was a huge hoax, too. That was never about social justice. Are you kidding? Who actually works for, you know, that hard for social justice anymore, you know, or ever did? I mean, communism was just a front for the central bankers to own everything and control everything, and that's what they want to impose on the whole world. So communism was a huge hoax. Zionism was a hoax. Like, most Jews didn't want to have to go to Israel and do what they've done there. I'm sure they don't feel good about
Israel,
it.
Of course, the most outrageous, racist nation on the face of the earth.
Exactly. So that was a hoax. They all come from the same source, these movements, all these isms. And feminism is so anti-woman, I can't even express it, because a woman essentially has, at most, 10 years, you know, her window of opportunity. Because she's, you know, we are natural creatures. She's a natural creature. Her fertility, you know, peaks, you know, at late teens, early 20s. That's when she's irresistible to men. That's when she has to form a lifelong relationship. That's what religions understood when they said, you know, no sex without marriage. Because, you know, it forced men to take women seriously as people, because they couldn't just get sex. They had to, love this person.
They got the whole package.
They had to get the whole package.
Yeah.
And now women think it's so liberating that they give this for nothing to men. You know, it's so sad, because these women now think that their only standard of value is whether a man wants to abuse them, you know, take advantage of them.
Well, and you're making points and statements here that are I hope all of you are grasping this. He's not talking about women being worthless after 30 or 35. That's not what his point is. It's much more succinct than that. In the larger sense, we are all powerful, both sexes, throughout our lives. But in terms of reproduction, the power therein, power to generate a family and all of that, it's a very important issue.
Gee, honey, those new sandals look great.
Okay, right back. Conversation with Dr. Henry Mackow tonight. Talking to a mother today. Two boys in high school. And I told her that I had heard about how our young women, 13, 14, 15, 16, are watching the movies and thinking it's very cool to have oral sex and all the rest of it. And how sad it's going to be later on if they ever do have to confront all of this high mileage behavior later on. And she said they won't. They won't face it. They're all doing it. My boys tell me what's going on. You can't believe what's going on. And these kids are literally throwing away their most important assets, their currency, as it were, in many cases. They have no parameters of behavior that they understand. Morality is viewed as an old-fashioned hindrance and very uncool in many cases. There are exceptions. We're just speaking in generalities here. But the media shapes the culture. I don't believe it's the other way around. And I believe that the manipulators that are at the top, they want this to happen. Communism, of course, always talked about cheapening sex, promoting pornography, homosexuality, and all the rest of it. And those goals have been achieved.
Exactly, Jeff. But that's the paradigm we want to understand. What we are being turned into, society is being turned into, is essentially a homosexual society. Now you say, well, how can we be homosexuals? After all, it's men doing it with women and vice versa, so that's not homosexual. But that's the wrong way to see homosexuality. Homosexuality is the inability to form a permanent bond with someone of the opposite sex.
Inability. Almost socially, what's the word? Interpersonally crippled.
It's a disorder. It's a disorder.
It's a psychological disorder.
Right. It's a developmental disorder.
And they never can. It's very tough to go back and reconstruct that.
Right. Now, because the only thing that can sort of quench the sexual and spiritual need is a permanent bond with a member of the opposite sex. Now, homosexuals, due to abuse when they're young or due to too much mommy, not enough daddy, they don't have the psychology to form this bond with a member of the opposite sex. So they compensate by doing it with members of the same sex, but it's a kind of unsatisfying, it never can satisfy them because they're never really getting what they want.
Well, that accounts for the often very high volume of partners each year for these people.
Well, exactly. You see, homosexuals, not all of them, but the vast majority of them have something like 100 partners a year. Over half of them, I've read, have over 100 partners a year. I mean, this is because they're trying to compensate for the fact that they can't find love. They can't find a permanent bond. Now, I know a minority of them do, and I respect that. But we're talking about the majority. We're talking about the homosexual paradigm. And that paradigm is now being imposed on so-called heterosexuals. We're homosexual because we are no longer able to form these permanent bonds. Now, these girls who are, you know, giving themselves or giving sex to boys indiscriminately, do you think they're going to be able to last in a marriage, especially when things get tough?
Well, no, everything's been cheapened. And, you know, you can't roll the odometer back, folks. You just can't. Doesn't happen. You run up the miles are there. Car never drives like it used to.
Well,
to use
you know,
that kind of a cliche.
I'm not quite as pessimistic as you.
Well, I'm not pessimistic. I'm telling you what's going on, what I see.
Oh, I know what's going on, but I'm saying that these movements for abstinence and so on, if society ever, you know, got a grip and was able to change its tune, I think that would be well received and would have a very positive effect. I think it's very important that men and women relearn how they relate to each other. And not to plug myself, I don't make any money from this, but I've got 20 or 30 articles on my website on how heterosexuality works. My website being savethemales.ca. None of us are taught how it works, therefore, because they don't want it to work. You see, the key what the elite has done is they've separated sex from reproduction. They're the people who are behind the birth control pill. They're the people who are behind sexual liberation. They essentially want to create a kind of brave new world where people spend all their time thinking about sex and having sex, but not having children and not thinking about raising children.
The two have been almost completely divorced from each other, the two.
Exactly. But you cannot divorce these two without doing extreme psychological damage to men and women.
I completely agree.
You know, because once you separate the two, essentially, then people, there's no social or psychological or cultural context to sex. Basically, people will want to do it with anyone who looks attractive, and that's what we've got, right? It's chaos. It's anarchy. And it's now invading into teenagers and even children. You've got children on the net. You've got predators. It's just anarchy. I mean, if people thought in terms of sex is the act of procreation, you know, it's having children. If they thought that having children was and raising them properly was their primary goal in life, they would have a focus.
That's not procreation, it's recreation.
Exactly. They've changed procreation into recreation because that's what they want to do. They want us to, in a sense, spill our seed, waste our energy, and not have a focus, a healthy, constructive focus in life.
Well, look at the reproductive rates are down. Everything's down.
It's all deliberate. It's all being done top down.
We've talked about that for many, many years on this program, and you're 100% correct. Nothing happens accidentally. Back in just a minute. Amidst all of the confusion in sexual roles anymore, the idea of promiscuity being the norm now and the desirable path to follow for most of our young people is absolutely going to destroy generation after generation until and unless it can be reversed. These kids, as you've made abundantly clear, and it's absolutely without argument, will in most cases, in many cases, the majority of cases, not be able to find themselves happily ensconced in a long-term relationship because they have been frivolous in their pursuits and expressing themselves at this most special level, which is, again, something that is reserved for all species on the planet to recreate themselves and to perpetuate themselves. So how do you go back from treating sex like a box of Kleenex, just one after another, or like taxi cabs, always another one coming along, to being one who is very much of a mind that sex is special and a relationship is extremely wonderful, lots of work and all the rest of those things we could talk about for hours. I don't know how kids are going to get there, because you look at them when they're 18, 19 now, you look in their eyes and they've been there and done it so many times, a lot of them look like they're just zombies. They're fried. There's nothing going on. That's kind of sad.
Yeah. I don't... It's kind of funny because, you know, I'm 56 now. I'm, you know, finally emerging from the hormonal haze where I'm not controlled by it. You know, it's really controlled by testosterone and those desires. And it gives you a bit of perspective. And one of the things I'm realizing is that all sexual attraction is related to reproduction. We're attracted to females who are at the height of their fertility, who are basically, their whole being is saying, I'm ready to have a child. And they radiate, you know, beauty, because that's the way nature says this woman is ready to have a child.
A beautiful flower blooming.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. So you cannot separate sex from reproduction. It's what sex is all about, reproduction, and yet they you know, want to turn that into some kind of a meaningless recreation, which they try to pretend is mystical. And,
well, it's a media cash cow, is what it is now.
Yeah, because they
sell everything with it.
Yeah, because you don't have a steady relationship. Like, people think that having casual sex, you're getting more sex. No, that's really, that sex isn't satisfying, and it's much harder to get, because you have to work at it every time. If you have a happy and healthy marriage, that's when sex comes easy. In a normal marriage, that's when you don't have to work at it. You know, that's when you really get it, and that's when you can move on to other things, and you realize that sex isn't all that important. I mean, unless you don't have it. But the big thing there, they had to do, is separate sex from reproduction. So now, you know, and what happens now is, like, young women, like, they think that all their power comes from that. And I think the mistake men make is falling into that trap, into you know, just giving them power, because that already makes it impossible to have a good relationship. That in heterosexuality, I've written this many times, you have the heterosexual exchange is the exchange of female power for male love. In other words, the woman surrenders her power. She entrusts it to a man who uses it to love her. In other words, she empowers him to love her. And we live in a society where that heterosexual exchange is being sabotaged deliberately, where women are being told to hang on to the power, not to obey men, not to empower men, but to challenge and compete with men. So men don't no longer have the power to love them. In fact, men are being made redundant, and that's deliberate. And and no permanent relationship can result from that. Like, I know this will sound seem very controversial, especially given the brainwashing we're receiving. But men should look for women with the idea of finding a sidekick, a helper, and someone dedicated to them, someone who's on their team. That's what men need to look for.
And it works both ways, of course.
Well, yes, it works because no one's going to want to be on your team unless you make them happy to be on your team, right? So it's definitely a two-way street. And that's what I mean when I talk about that heterosexual equation. The woman empowers the man by obeying the man. The man uses that power to love the woman. In other words, to make her happy.
When you say obey, a lot of people are going to react negatively to that and say, what is he talking about, subservience? I'm not subservient to anyone. You're not using the word obey in its traditional sense, are you?
No, I'm not. I don't mean subservient. I mean, submissive. And then that doesn't mean not having your own views and your own ideas. And a man doesn't want
to... But that's
how
it's always been played, submission.
Yeah.
There's a dominant and a submissive, but that's a transitory and a transient situation, and it's... The labels are misleading because the submissive one, in many people's views, is the one who is actually the dominant one. There has to be power there to give.
Exactly. There's an interchange. A man does not want to control his wife. He doesn't want to make her miserable.
He shouldn't.
Well, he'd be a fool because...
There are a lot of fools out there, unfortunately, but
yeah,
you're right. Yeah.
Because essentially she's his team. You know, you want your team to be, like, happy.
Right.
You know, happy. So you're going to do you're going to give her what she needs to be happy.
A provider.
A provider, exactly. And that doesn't mean providing just material things. It means providing spiritual and social and emotional sustenance.
We keep forgetting that there are apples and there are oranges, and this whole thing is to say they're all just apples out there. They're not. It's two totally different things. People forget. There's a blurring.
Men and women were designed to interact in this way, and they're deliberately... Women want to surrender to a man. They want to be possessed by a man who will love them purely and totally. That's what they want.
Well, he has to, in a way, be the medium in which she can grow and reach her full potential.
Yes.
Is that fair? Is that what I think you're saying is something like that?
Yes, because her full potential, and I know this is heresy, is reached through being a wife and a mother, not through being an assistant loan manager at the local bank.
Well, the feminists are going
to... Where she has to kiss some other man's ass who doesn't give a damn about her.
That's right, and they don't like it. And, of course, the feminists will hate you for all these statements again, and maybe me for some of mine. But how many women have you met who just they've been in a professional field 5, 10 years, whatever. And I've met tons of them, and they hate it. They're tired of fighting against chauvinist, sexist men and all the harassment that comes with that. They're trying to compete all the time to prove in some ways that they're better than the other people. And then, of course, you have the women. Well, they call the trite cliche is catfighting, but women. Rachel, doggone, I can't remember her name. Rachel Simmons wrote a book called Odd Girl Out. And if you folks want to get an idea of what it's like to be a young woman today, a teenager, and what this is going to be, and these characteristics will be carried with these teens into their young adulthood, and how vicious it is, oh man, it's unbelievable. It drives some of these young girls to suicide. It ruins them for life. So you've got all that catty thing going on too. And
the message for young men is, you have the power, and you have to insist on having the power, and you have to insist, you have to exercise it responsibly and lovingly.
Well, there's another problem.
Because women aren't interested in men who don't insist on having the power. Women are attracted to powerful men like sliced jam.
You know, if you ever go, and I read a story about this, this online dating service thing, what women almost invariably list as a turn-on or a desirable trait, and they put down power. Power. Or brains. Power.
Right. Well, women want to be loved by a powerful man. In other words, a man who will use them for a positive, as they were intended to be used, as wives,
really?
Which is companions,
right.
As partners, and as mothers.
As soon as
that's
a man
the way,
becomes...
See, and this is the thing that homosexuals want. This is the thing that heterosexuals want. What all people want is a bond with another human being who they can trust
right.
completely.
And, trust is everything, and once a trust is betrayed, well, there's nothing worse than the betrayal of a trust. That's about as bad as it gets.
Right, and that begins with any kind of promiscuity, you know. That's why monogamy is the foundation
right.
of trust and of happiness.
There is promiscuity of different degrees, too. There's physical promiscuity, there's emotional promiscuity, psychological promiscuity with other people. It goes on. It's a very complicated issue. Henry, thank you for being here tonight. Thanks for writing, as you do, about so many things, so provocatively and informatively. They're just wonderful to read, even if people don't agree. I urge all of you to read Dr. Henry Macau's writings. Thank you, my friend.
Thanks very much, Jeff.
It's been a pleasure. Talk to you again. Okay, and thanks to all of you for being here. We'll be back in 21 hours tomorrow night. See you then.